This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
I'm Gemma Jones, an improvement coach based in the UK and working with the team at Baptist.
Well, folks, we have a delight today. You probably remember we had Julie Dirksen on several weeks back, and we talked to her about her book, Talk to the Elephant, Designing Learning for Behavior Change. And ever since that podcast, within our own team here at Baptist, we've been talking about that book. We've seen the book get a lot of attention on LinkedIn and other places. And we just really asked Julie, would you please come back and join us? And what we want to talk about today is training as an experiment. Many times in our industry, we talk about training as if it's a given, that if we just do it, it's like clicking a switch, that it'll automatically give us what we want. But that's not always the case. But before we jump right into talking about training as an experiment, Julie, would you tell our listeners, if they didn't hear the first podcast, a little bit about yourself and about your background?
Yeah, I am an instructional designer. I still identify that way, although sometimes I talk about being a learning strategist. But my background is in instructional design, educational technology. My degree is in instructional systems technology is the actual title. And I have been working on this sort of question of like, how do we improve our practice as training people? Because I sometimes jokingly say, I don't care what people know, I care what they do. And the knowledge is only a path to hopefully some kind of action that they're going to take. And so when we get into that, there's a lot of cases where, you know, we throw information at a problem and it's not fundamentally an information problem, which is where Talk to the Elephant came from, which is like, here are all the other reasons. But one of the other things that I think is really, really an issue is, even though we have a pretty sizable body of scientific research on behavior change and some of these kinds of things, this stuff is all so context dependent. It's all so much, well, it depends, right? Is this going to work or is this going to not work? Well, you know, maybe it worked in the lab or maybe it worked in, you know, another organization, but exactly how it's going to play out in your organization and in your context really, really depends. And so I sort of view all of the research literature as a starting place. It can hopefully save you some time and get you the best, you know, kind of test conditions to begin with. But then you still have to figure out, is this actually having the result that we want to have?
Julie, that's a great way to start. I mean, I love this. I love your book, Talk to the Elephant. Those of you that don't have a copy, you need to go get one. It's powerful. I love the concept that we talked about last time of sticky learning. And I really like that term because, you know, sometimes we talk about training for the sake of training and we talk about how people learn. And I think we make lots of assumptions in the healthcare space today about training as a silver bullet solution. Mm-hmm. And so how can we bridge that to, I really love your kickoff because it puts the emphasis back on the leader to be able to determine and decipher what is going to work in that area instead of just maybe an assumption. I don't know. Will you unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah. And I mean, we have this challenge, right? Because we've got, you know, the big question is always, what's the purpose of the training? What are you hoping to accomplish? What's the thing that's going to be different afterwards? You know, I've got about 90 different ways to ask that question, because sometimes you really have to like keep chewing on it before you get a real, like, here's what we're really hoping people will do. And, you know, sometimes the answer to the question is, we need the documented paperwork that we train these people in case we get sued. You know, and so sometimes the answer is legal defensibility, in which case it kind of doesn't matter if the training worked. I mean, that's a cynical thing to say, but it also may or may not be, you know, applied to something. But if we sort of set that whole, you know, side of things, the compliance piece aside, you know, which is often about meeting the requirements or, you know, things like that. And we go, okay, here's training that we're doing because we really hope somebody's going to do something different. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about the documentation and it's not about, you know, prepping the legal defense. We really want people to do something differently based on this. There is an outcome that we want to see. And I mean, the first part of that is sometimes hard getting specific enough about it. You know, we want to be patient focused. Well, great. So what does that actually look like? Like, I have a question that I'll sometimes ask about, if I took a photo or a video of somebody being patient focused, what would I see? Because we get the same language in other areas, customer focused or, whatever that is. And it's kind of like, or safety focused or, any of those kinds of things. We tend to have done a good job of defining those behaviors in high risk contexts, because when we know that, if we don't do this right, somebody dies, we're going to be pretty specific about what behaviors, and we're going to do the heavy lifting to figure that out. But in a lot of these other cases, it hasn't been figured out. Like, we don't exactly know, we kind of have a general sense. And so, like DEI stuff is one of those, and it's possibly, I shouldn't even bring that up, but because I know that's a hot button issue for people. But regardless, I see a lot of like DEI training where it doesn't have very specific behaviors associated with it. And there's a good reason for that. It's hard. It's hard to be really specific about, this is exactly what I want you to do, because again, context is really, it changes its, the right answer is really context dependent. But it's also not realistic to expect that you can train people on something conceptually and then it's going to make a difference to their actual behaviors if we don't know what those behaviors are. So the first part of doing the experiment is just having a really well-defined success condition. Like, what does this look like if we think it's going to work? Or what data are we collecting? What's going to, my friend Kathy Moore, who's a great instructional designer, always had the question she'd ask stakeholders, what measure that you are already collecting will change if this project is successful? And if they said, we're not collecting, well, she's like, okay, let's start there then,
Right, that's great. Yeah, I think a good example for us may be patient experience, and you talked about patient, or customer focus. It's really important to us. And I think it's really hard because we think we've identified the right behaviors, and there's a lot of evidence-based practice to support that, but it often doesn't really translate to the outcome that we want. And so I think that, I don't know, that's an area that we continue to focus on that we want to get right. And it's, I don't know, I think this topic is very helpful in that space.
Yeah, I was talking to you, I've talked over the years to a few different colleagues about like onboarding programs. And so onboarding programs, somebody starts working there and they go through an onboarding program into the organization. And, there's practical stuff like, here's how you log into your email, or here's where the bathrooms are, or here's, here, this is our policy on like cybersecurity. And there's parts of onboarding that are like that. But then there's always this kind of intangible, right? Which is, I would work on these with some clients, and there's always sort of like a history of the organization. And it's like, well, do they really need to know that it was founded in, 1952 and whatever, whatever. But when we really got down to it, we were starting to sort of say, well, we want people to like be curious and to find out more. And so, a colleague of mine was like, well, do they click into any of the more information links? Like, that's something we can measure. And also we were talking about the fact that like, well, what do you really want the feeling to, like, what are you really hoping that this accomplishes? And somebody in one of my design sessions was like, I want them to go home and tell their partner or friend or, family member or whatever, how excited they are to work for this organization. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's starting to like point us towards a thing that we could actually, measure and, look at. Like, that's an effective goal, but it is one that we could, I don't know if, I can't remember exactly where we wound up on the data on that one, but I mean, we were looking at like, okay, we want to sort of see, are people walking away from their onboarding experience going, are they like overloaded with like minutia and details, or genuine excitement to like join the organization? And that starts to turn into something that we can kind of then look at, what would we do to measure it, or how would we think about that? And so, step one is actually, what does good look like? What does success look like?
And I'm thinking about those things you can measure and define as success. And maybe that's about behaviors. Maybe there's something in there about language. But I'm wondering about the time frame, Julie, if you've got any thoughts on, because one of my least favorite things is when you go to a training course and, as you're leaving the door, they shove a piece of paper at you where you've got to say how wonderful the training was. And then that's their success metric. But sometimes you also get an email the next morning, so, you know, and that's how they measure success. But I'm wondering if it actually would be better to give people a chance to, you know, sit with, process, use some of the things they've maybe learned on the course. Like, is there a best time to kind of go and do that reflection and that measurement?
Yeah, and it depends on what we're, again, what we're looking for, right? You know, part of the reason they shove it at you on the way out the door is that that's their best response, right? Right? Like, they're most likely to get something for you if they kind of like don't let you leave the room until you've done it. But which, you know, because low response rates on, you know, stuff like that is really an issue. And, you know, there's a real limit to what we're going to find out from those kinds of surveys anyway. They're not useless, but Will Thalhimer has a book on learner, a performance focused learner surveys that is, I think, as good as it's going to get in terms of what, how can we write these in a way that we're actually getting, you know, at least somewhat predictive results. But then, you know, like the other thing that I really like to see is, you know, and the time frame depends on, well, when do I think somebody might actually use this, right? Like, I taught you a thing and you're probably not going to use it tomorrow. You might not use it for a few weeks. Then things like time frame would be, you know, kind of come into play with that. I was working with a client who did marketing courses, and they taught all of these people all these models and these tools for marketing courses. And so one of the things we talked about for data collection afterwards was, you know, come back to them a month or 6 weeks later and say, which of these tools are you actually using, you know, as opposed to, was this helpful or did you like it? But like, okay, which are making the jump out of the classroom and actually into use for people? And if, you know, these are and these aren't, then that starts to give you some indication of, then it's, you know, then it has to have a follow-up question. Are you not using it because it's not useful to you? Are you not using it because you didn't understand it? Are you not using it because it's too hard? You know, like, are you not using it for all sorts of reasons? But then, you know, like trying to get people to report on what they're doing instead of how they feel about things is I think part of the conversation. And, you know, like, I'm a big fan. We tend to view evaluation as a population-wide activity. So I want to know, did this whole group of people change their behavior? You know, so if I'm, you know, rolling out this course to 12,000 nurses, I want results from, you know, the biggest swath of that population I can get. But there is this thing where you can do little scale experiments with a small cohort and actually gather some of the data that just would be impractical to collect at scale. I can't go watch all 12,000 nurses use this IV infusion machine. Like, that's just not a thing that can happen. But can I go watch 20 nurses use the IV infusion machine? I probably can. I mean, it's not inexpensive, but it's not like prohibitively costly. And then I can find out, okay, I think they should be able to do these six things on this device based on this training. Can I go collect that data and find out, can they do the six things I thought they were supposed to do correctly and accurately and at speed, or, you know, whatever measures we think are important? And then if I find out they can do 2, 4, and 6, but not 1, 3, and 5, you know, then in the ideal world, that would inform, you know, come back to the training and we'd be like, all right, we need to look at what's going on with 1, 3, and 5 that those particular things didn't transfer across. And that's not a small amount of work, but it's also possibly what we should be doing if we really genuinely want this to be effective. And, you know, you're not going to do that level of effort for everything, but if it's really a critical thing, can we do that? Can we figure out? And with the intangibles, you know, the, you know, patient experience stuff, or, you know, things that are, that feel a little bit, there's a question in therapy that I always like, which is, you know, a therapist might be working with somebody with, you know, an alcohol substance abuse issue, and the person really wants to, you know, change their life and they're very committed to it, but they're struggling. Like, there's this kind of like magic question thing they'll ask sometimes, which is, say, if you woke up tomorrow, everything was better and you didn't have this problem anymore, what are the first things that you would notice that would be different? And they'd be like, oh, well, I'd be able to have a nice conversation with my spouse, or I'd have the energy to get up and, you know, make myself coffee, or I'd have the energy to work out, or, you know, like whatever these things are, the what's the first thing you would see that would tell you that this is working? And I think that that's kind of a nice question, which is, if everything about this worked, you know, we did some kind of training to improve patient experience, and if everything we did about this worked, what would be the things that I would see in the world or in my environment that tells me that this is working, that this is, that something's different now? And then that can be a way to kind of Because a lot of times it's hard to translate these into concrete, and it's hard to do experiments or set up test conditions or gather data if they aren't concrete. But, you know, like different strategies for figuring out how to make those things more concrete for people.
And it seems to me that if you've done that thinking up front of what things are going to look different if this is successful, that's only going to help you deliver the training in a much more effective way. And if you
right.
if it's not that way, that's going to come back and it's going to feed in and you're going to redevelop or refine the training anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we have a very one and done attitude with training. We don't typically design the design process. We don't typically construct the design process around the idea that it's going to need to be iterated. And that's a challenge. That's a really hard thing because that's not how it's budgeted. That's not how the schedule's done, you know, any of those kinds of things. And honestly, I mean, I love my instructional designers, and I think we're, you know, good and conscientious people in most cases, but we're also, the likelihood we're going to get it right out of the gate with absolutely zero need for refinement is not high. It's an issue.
Well, it's not realistic at all, is it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
It really isn't.
No. You know, Julie, I'm really wrestling with my thoughts because, again, you're sharing so much wisdom. This is so good. And it makes, like, organizationally, though, this makes sense in kind of, it makes a lot of sense to me on the unit level, like at the smallest. Mm-hmm. And then, but I'm also really struggling when you have to scale to kind of organizational. And so, we're a big healthcare organization. We span three states. You know, we have 24 hospitals. Talk about how you take and scale. What's the scalability of really getting to something on a much larger scale?
Yeah, and you know, the sort of the idea of kind of running experiments and things like that, by definition, they're probably going to be small scale. And then the challenge is, does this generalize? Does this scale to other? So if you're doing a little experiment on this training in, you know, your particular hospital in your particular location with a small unit or something like that, the issue is, you know, then if this works here and we decide, yeah, we've refined it, we think we're feeling pretty good about it, then does it scale to the wider organization? And so having some checks in place around that, you know, there's a little bit of the challenge between the practical and the ideal. You know, in the ideal world, we would, you know, test it other places and continue to refine. In the practical world, you know, one of the big issues with training, and it's the same is true for quality assurance, is we tend to be at the end of the process, which is not great, but it, you know, like if you're making an organizational change, you got to figure out all the things of like, what's the change that you're making, and then kind of training shows up. And so obviously involving the training conversation earlier, you know, building a pilot phase in for us to do some of that iteration and some of that testing, you know, those are things that can absolutely improve. But the truth of the matter is, like, the world has got to keep moving and, you know, things have to continue to happen. And so, you know, being realistic about the balance between, you know, let's make it perfect versus let's get something useful out. You know, and I always lean towards the let's get something useful out, you know, and that's part of it.
Let me follow up with that and say, what is your, I mean, in our industry, you hear lots of, on scale, you hear lots of people talk about evidence-based practices. I'm curious mm-hmm. what your thought is around that. And what do you think about evidence-based practice?
Yeah, and I still fundamentally think it's a starting place, right? It gives you the hypothesis that you should be using to construct your initial conditions that then you test in you know, a specific environment.
No, I think it's a great answer. And what I'm hearing is it's not a silver bullet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a starting point to the journey to get whatever outcome that you want in your space.
Yeah.
I think that's meaningful for leaders. And again, a lot of our listeners are healthcare leaders across the country. And so I think, and again, I want to emphasize and really encourage leaders. I mean, you know, you want to use all the tools that are out there, but it's still up to the leader to create and to know what kind of outcomes mm-hmm. and know what kind of things are only going to work for their area of responsibility. And I think mm-hmm. oftentimes it's easy for us to take that away or to give the impression that it's not owned at the leader level. And I think that's really, I think that's really critical.
Yeah, I mean, one of the examples I use of something where, you know, it's an interesting piece from an evidentiary point of view, when we look at like the behavioral science literature, is Wikipedia. So when you go out to Wikipedia these days, they will immediately ask you for money, and I get it. I can't figure out how to get them to not ask me, given that I do actually give them money on a regular basis, but you know, that's a whole separate issue. But one of the things they'll say is they'll say that the vast majority of people don't donate, and you know, here's why in order to maintain this resource, we need your help kind of thing. And in the research, in like the social norming research literature, they will tell you, don't norm to a low, you know, no, don't norm down. Don't say very few people are doing this, because that usually decreases the behavior. I don't have any insights into exactly how Wikipedia is doing this, but I'm pretty sure they've A/B tested this, right? I'm pretty sure they figured out that this is a useful message for them, because I think they know real well what works and what doesn't work in terms of increasing donations. So the conventional wisdom is don't norm to a low number, but they're clearly doing that because they've figured out that this is ultimately an effective thing. So even though we have this guideline in the research literature that says this is how you do social norming, the answer is, but it kind of depends. It depends on your circumstances, and it depends on your audience, and it depends on all of those kinds of things.
Really, really good.
So I've waited as long as I could wait before I kind of jumped in, because this is just so good. So let me kind of build the question up. You know, Jim and I work a lot to try to do debriefing practices, because we're very much in the belief of iterating. But one of the things I've just noticed in my personal just years of attempting to train and communicate and another adult is we start off almost with, it feels to me, and feel free, I want you to dismantle this, Julie, if you don't agree. We start off with a presupposition that if things don't go well, it's the learner's fault. Mm-hmm. You know, and the reason I say that, you know, we practice something called TWI, job instructions, that's been around since the 40s, and they have a little phrase that if the worker hasn't learned, the instructor hadn't taught. I love that. It holds me accountable. But I have found that that phrase does step on some people's toes. Mm-hmm. And my wife, being a dyslexic therapist, where supposedly 25% of the population are dyslexic, I've seen decades where these young kids would come to her and the school system has them failing. Mm-hmm. And within 6 months, they're making straight A's. Mm-hmm. And so it was really about how the material was being delivered to that child. And so often I see what I've had to learn to do, and this is just my own technique, is I'm just watching your eyes. And mm-hmm. if your eyes look confused, I assume that Skip is not communicating very well.
Right.
And I've got to figure out how to communicate in a better. Have you discovered that same line of thinking, or would you disagree with any of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that I sort of talk about at the beginning of the elephant book is that I'll have clients who come in and they're like, they're just lazy. And I'm like, oh, wow. You know, that's an issue. Let's unpack that one a little bit, because I don't know any lazy people. I'm sure they exist. I'm sure there are lazy people in the world, but I'm like, if you hired a whole audience of lazy people, maybe we have other problems that aren't training. You know, maybe it's your hiring practices, or maybe they have better things to do, right? And there's a quote, it's W. Edwards Deming, I think, is attributed to it, but it's a murky attribution, but it's the every system is perfectly designed to get the result it gets. And so if you're getting a result you don't like, the question is, what about this system is perfectly designed to get that result? And training, I think you're absolutely right. Like if they're not doing, then you maybe aren't training, you know, like there's definitely things, but I've also seen perfectly effective training that doesn't have the desired effect because they went back to the workplace and there were like 37 barriers thrown up in their, you know, in their wake before they even could get started on something. In fact, literally the slide I tend to use to explain, you know, environmental barriers is one where a nurse is saying, hey, I'm ready to get started with that nice new method on patient-centered care. Okay. And the administrator is like, yeah, great, fill out these 25 forms first, you know? And so the challenge with a lot of this stuff is really kind of figuring out like what is the barrier? And, you know, we're back to the behavior change stuff. It looks at, is the barrier the capability of the person? In which case, if people are leaving training and they don't have the capability, then 100% there's an issue there and needs to be addressed. But if they have the capability and what's lacking is social support, or what's lacking is environmental support, or that the systems are bad, or that it's too hard to do the thing, or it's, you know, or is it that they're not motivated? In which case, I still think blaming the learner for not being motivated is a problem, because there's almost always something happening in the system that is creating that lack of motivation. It might be that I don't understand how this behavior ties to my identity and values. It might be that the incentives are not aligned very well. And, you know, we say we want you to be customer centered, but we're also beating on you hard to reduce your talk time on, you know, customer service calls. It might be that we've over-egged some of the goals. You know, I always, for misaligned incentives, I always use the Wells Fargo example, where the customer service people had been given cross-selling goals that were so aggressive, the only way they could do it was, you know, cheating essentially. So they would sign customers up for stuff they didn't know they'd signed up for. And it was like, well, you know, yeah, these customer service people were doing something that was illegal and that was real bad for the organization, but the organization kind of created this problem, you know, in the way that they set up sales targets for this, you know, unrealistic sales targets for this audience. So the question is always, what about this system is creating this issue? Or, you know, or what about the system is failing to support the, you know, the behavior that we want to see? And it could, like I said, could absolutely be training. And I absolutely also do that thing where you look for the light in the eye and you kind of go, which is one of the challenges with virtual training, right? It's so much harder to see, are people getting it? Like, that's a lack of feedback that's happening a ton in virtual training environments. And I think is going to be one of the things we're going to have to reckon with, is good instructors use a lot of physical cues to understand what they need to like spend more time on, for example. And they're missing a lot of those cues now, because I have a big screen with my slides and I have little teeny tiny boxes, and I can only see like six of the people in the class at, you know, at the time when I'm talking about a thing. And I am not a fan. I don't love it, but it's also the reality of a distributed workforce and kind of where we are for things.
Well, I had a question about you. You used the term early, Julie, being a learning strategist. But I got to be honest, I would love your answer here, but I got to be honest, after two kind of conversations with you, I get it a lot more. Like, I love hearing you talk about how we learn and about how to organize that. Will you talk about the term learning strategist a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, I call myself a learning strategist because I think that that's a term that people can wrap their head around. But we had performance improvement, which was a big term in the 80s and 90s. You don't hear it quite as much anymore as you used to. But really, that's what we're here to do. You know, I was actually just doing a course for kind of new instructional designers. And, you know, yes, your job is to make good learning experiences, but really your job is to support organizational goals. How do we help people with things like that? And so that's kind of fundamentally what I think the, you know, a learning strategist should be doing is, and we're a, you know, we kind of come in at a particular point in the process. Usually it would be nice if it was earlier, but that's part of the whole conversation. And I think we're one of the, you know, people who's potentially in a good place to kind of identify what might be some of the issues for people as part of their learning experience. Because I am, you know, you mentioned the fact that training gets handed a lot. You know, and every time there's a big screw up in an organization, they will always promise to do training. Like, that is always part of the apology. We're going to do training. And I always think, okay, I like job security, but at the same time, are you sure this is a training issue? Because I think there might be a few other things going on. And so, to my mind, being a learning strategist is helping be part of that conversation to make sure that we're being realistic about what training can do and what it really, really can't. So, because, you know, I like a good challenge. I'm always happy to try to take it on. But I we absolutely have to ensure that part of the conversation is what else needs to happen or what else needs to be in place to support this.
That's great. You know, I've got one other that I'm really curious about. I think we've all been in training environments, and you kind of talked about this, Julie, but we've all been, you know, you're kind of in a training environment and the trainees come into the environment and you're like, you can pick out the people and you're like, I don't know how they got here, but they're not prepared on a number of different fronts. Either they're not engaged or they're not interested. They don't want to be there, et cetera. So what makes me think about is the complexity of this system that we're talking about, of, you know, the hiring, the onboarding, the importance of making sure you have the right people that are prepared for whatever kind of training environment that you create, even if it's the right one, even if you're iterating and you've got what you feel like is right. Will you speak to kind of upstream and downstream what you see around the training event?
Yeah, well, sorry, is the concept of anti-fragility something that you've talked about? It's Nassim Taleb's book. The book is a little bit, it's actually good to start with some of his like YouTube lectures and stuff, because I think the, and I don't know if the editor was in full control of text editing in the book, but I think when he explains it in the lectures and stuff, it's a little bit more succinct. But he talks about how there's systems and there's fragile systems. So like, you know, the real estate market in 2008 was a fragile, was it 2006? Whenever that was, it was a fragile system. And once it started to unravel, it unraveled in a, you know, big way and stuff like that. So it was a system where, you know, like it had been built on really shaky foundations and it kind of all collapsed. And then he talks about how we sort of think about a robust system as being the opposite of a fragile system, which is a system that can just take a lot of abuse, take a lot of punches, and it's still going to hold and it's still going to hold. But he sort of says, no, the real opposite of a fragile system is an anti-fragile system. And the classic example of an anti-fragile system is your immune system, which is abuse makes it stronger. So every incursion you have kind of increases the strength of the system. And so that's kind of one of the things that we're always trying to figure out is how do we develop anti-fragile systems? And we were talking about experiments and things like that. And that can absolutely happen as part of the pilot process for a training program. But one of the people I interviewed for the book, who you should actually also totally talk to, Sebastian Bailey, he's out of a company in the UK called Mangym. And he talks about how one of the, and he's somebody who's really using a lot of the behavioral science in order to inform their organizational coaching and things like that. But he was talking about how they would do these learning labs. I think that was the term he used for it. It's in, you know, it's in his interview in the book. But he was talking about how I'm going to teach you how to do this thing, but I'm also going to teach you how to collect your own data about the efficacy of you applying this thing.
Love
and
that.
So kind of pushing down the testing and the experimenting and the experimental mindset down way lower in terms of, okay, I learned this method for coaching my employees. What data will tell me that it's working? How can I figure out how to get better at it? You know, all of those kinds of things. And so when that capability of testing it, and you need to provide some structure and you need to help people understand how to do it and all of these kinds of things. But if you can push that down to that level, then what you have is more of this anti-fragile system, which when there's an issue, there's kind of a self-repairing mechanism that matches at that level. So I think that's really you know, if you can do that, then I think that's the really, you know, the sort of magical, you know, systemic kinds of approaches to the solution.
Such great insight.
Well, yeah. Julie, this has been wonderful. This went so much faster than I thought it would go. And we even stretched it a little bit, but I keep thinking we're going to have you a lot more. So this has been just wonderful. Folks, if you didn't hear it the first time, please go out, look up Julie Dirksen, look up her books, look up Talk to the Elephant. That's our favorite right now within Baptist. Talk to the Elephant, Designing Learning for Behavior Change. Go look it up. Go check her out on YouTube. She's all out there. She's just got a great work, and she's such a pure student of this area. And so we are so grateful for you, Julie, and you sharing your pearls of wisdom. And we're just so grateful. So on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much, Julie.
Yeah, thank you. These are such fun conversations. So thanks for having me.